Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com. You can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, Russia's Sputnik Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, and Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. We will begin with NHK World Radio Japan. Russia and the U.S. have agreed to extend the last remaining nuclear arms treaty for another 5 years. In Hiroshima, workers are preserving the Peace Memorial, one of the few structures to survive the nuclear bombing in 1945. At the World Economic Forum, the Chinese president has warned about the risks of a new Cold War, calling on global leaders to commit to cooperation rather than confrontation. NHK Japan.
President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin have agreed to extend the last remaining nuclear arms treaty between their countries. The two leaders spoke by phone for the first time since Biden took office last week. The new START, or Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, was at the heart of the conversation, as it was due to expire on February 5th. The White House says the two sides agreed to work urgently to extend the pact for another 5 years. The Kremlin welcomed the move. Signed in 2010, the treaty is widely regarded as the cornerstone of global arms control. It limits the number of strategic nuclear warheads, missiles, and bombers that the world's two biggest nuclear powers can deploy. The U.S. and Russia had failed to narrow their differences over the extension under former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration. Trump had wanted to attach conditions to a deal.
In western Japan, a lasting testament to the horrors of nuclear war is getting new life. Workers are preserving the Hiroshima Peace Memorial, one of few structures to survive an atomic bombing. Also known as the Atomic Bomb Dome, it stood for 100 years. Work to protect the decaying structure began in September after a lack of interest in the restoration contract forced significant delays. Reporters got the chance on Wednesday to see how work is progressing, including painting these steel frames. They'll now match the color shown in a photo taken soon after the bombing.
By bringing back the color it had right after the atomic bombing, I hope both local residents and people around the world will be reminded of the tragedy.
Workers are also using historically accurate materials, including lime, to fix damage. The work is now 70% complete and is set to wrap up by the end of March.
In China, where President Xi Jinping is warning about the risks of a new Cold War, calling on global leaders to commit to cooperation instead of confrontation. Xi made the comments during a virtual event for the World Economic Forum. He says starting a new Cold War will lead to threats, sanctions, and isolation.
A new Cold War will only push the world into division and possible confrontation.
She added that international governance should be based on rules and consensus, not on the order given by one or the few. Xi's comments comes amid rising tensions with the United States and was his first time addressing an international gathering since U.S. President Joe Biden took office. The remarks are seen as a message to Biden, who has pledged to strengthen U.S. alliances. The White House press secretary has said the Biden administration wants to handle relations with Beijing with strategic patience. Jen Psaki said Washington will consult with its allies on the path ahead. Saki said the Biden administration's views on China remain unchanged. She added Beijing is challenging American security, prosperity, and values in significant ways that require a new U.S. approach.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They are now heard from 8:30 to 9 p.m. at 6155-7245 and 7445, or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times they announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. On to Sputnik Radio. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi spoke with Jacobin founding editor Bhaskar Sunkara. They discussed the possible turning down of the American Cultural War, the causes of Central American migration, the problems with cabinet members being retired military and intelligence officers, the hope that the American people want an end to the U.S. intervention and meddling in other countries, and the return to multilateralism. Russia's Sputnik Radio.
But joining me now is the legend that is the publisher of Tribune and the founding editor of Jacobin, Bhaskar Sunkara.
Most of all, I'm just glad that the culture war of the last 4 years might possibly be over, or at least there's a pathway to ending it. I think both liberalism and conservatism in the U.S. have been driving themselves to the brink of insanity, and it's good to be on that, be seemingly moving beyond some of that insanity.
Even you, presumably, were impressed by these executive orders announced within hours of him taking the oath. XL Keystone Pipeline, Paris Climate Change, mask mandate, no Arctic drilling, anti-racism, the Dreamer Immigrant Program, the Trump Wall. Amazing.
I mean, some of these things are progressive measures. I think some of these things are steps forward. Obviously, the scope for what a U.S. president can do is somewhat limited. It's limited by the fact the U.S. system of government is extremely dysfunctional. You could do some things through executive order. You could do some things through a process called budget reconciliation, which allows us with a simple majority in the Senate and the House of Representatives to get through certain vital necessary measures. But on the whole, in the U.S. system, in order to get through any gridlock, you need a supermajority of 60 senators. The Democrats now only have 50 plus a tiebreaker in the form of the vice president. And the U.S. political system is such that if you really want to win the supermajority, if you're a Democrat, you have to win a supermajority of the popular vote.
Well, what surprised me was that Jen Psaki gave a press conference to the White House journalists very quickly afterwards and said that one priority would be to attend to the root causes of Central American immigration. Now, why flag that up, given that Joe Biden infamously supported the death squads of Central America?
Well, I think this is one thing where American liberalism as a whole seems to think that the world started in 2016, or at least American empire and all the bad things the U.S. did started with Trump upon his election. They seem to want to return us to a status quo ante, but of course we know that the United States was responsible for the destabilization of Honduras, removing or helping to remove domestic elites, a democratically elected center-left government.
And this is when Biden was vice president.
This is when Biden was vice president, and this was at the behest of figures like Hillary Clinton and contributing to the destabilization of this area, this region. And in general, if people are living in poverty, if people are living in crime-infested areas with no prospects for the future, wouldn't you want to get your family out of there? Wouldn't you want to go move to the U.S. or Canada or somewhere else that you have access to greater opportunities? The fact, though, that the United States has for decades prevented the emergence of left nationalist projects in these areas, or once they came to power, did everything possible to thwart their efforts. And then also the U.S. has said, well, we're going to remove the possibility of improving things for you at home, but we're also going to prevent you from going somewhere else. So I think that if American liberalism is serious about compassion towards migrants, as it should be, I believe that there should be a radically different immigration policy in the U.S., far more compassionate immigration policy in the U.S. They also need to be serious about the actions of U.S. empire abroad, particularly in the Americas.
Let's just go through then some of his picks.
They have all gone to the same couple schools in D.C., schools for foreign policy. They all have the same experience at places like Langley and elsewhere. It's become a very common thing for Democratic candidates, even for the House of Representatives, to trumpet their past positions as CIA analysts. And what you're also seeing in the Biden administration is military appointments at a very alarming level. So obviously, these are people who have recently retired from the U.S. military, but are now shuffled into government posts. And traditionally, that was frowned upon. It's not illegal in any way because they're retired figures. But what it does, it erodes the civilian basis of the Defense Department in the same way that putting figures from the intelligence community, so-called, as it's euphemistically called in the U.S. Media, into government posts right after undermines the point that we want civilian watchdogs of these repressive institutions. Obviously, some of these institutions like the CIA, I think, should be abolished overnight and do far more harm than good, make Americans and the world less safe, not more safe, but that's kind of outside the point. But even within the narrow confines of how the U.S. state has functioned before, I think there's an alarming turn from people who go from these intelligence organizations or from the military, go to the private sector, where they get rich really quickly in the span of 4 or 5 years, sitting on boards of companies like Raytheon and other defense companies, then go into government office when their guys get empowered. It's almost cynical. I don't think any of these people, or most of these people, have real political beliefs. The American people, not our intelligence elites, not our officers in our military, not our kind of foreign policy whizzes in Washington, are strongly against interventions abroad. The memory of the Iraq catastrophe is still very fresh. I think there's no public appetite for this expansion. I think even Trump's base held him to account and forced a drawdown of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Obama was from his base, obviously forced to do the same in Iraq. And I think this should give us hope. Obviously, have no hope or assurances that U.S. empire will be in better hands because Joe Biden is in power, but have some hope in a growing bipartisan consensus among the American people that intervention and war and meddling needs to stop. And I think this is a new and refreshing phenomenon, and it's the only thing that gives me hope in that regard.
Well, what are they going to do then with the $750 billion that have just been mandated for the Pentagon?
Well, I think there'll be continued attempts to exercise both U.S. Soft power, and also that comes with a very ugly side of sanctions and other destabilization efforts to fund proxies and spur asymmetrical warfare and so on, which comes with tremendous human cost and often doesn't get the same public scrutiny. I think if the American people knew what their tax dollars was funding vis-a-vis Gulf states in places like Yemen, they would be horrified at it. I think if the American people knew what was happening in Libya in their names and these interventions, if they think they knew the extent of U.S. involvement in Venezuela and elsewhere, they would be horrified. But that is at least a far cry from the direct military interventions that you saw in past administrations in past year. One thing I do want to push against is the idea that Trump lessened any part of U.S. empire. I think he, like Biden, represents more of a continuation of it without the same overt adventurism that you saw in the Bush administration, to some extent in the Obama administration. I think that we're not going to see in our lifetime any sort of large-scale conventional war, thank thank God for that. But we will see these continued proxy battles and asymmetrical warfare, which will claim a lot of lives of people in the global South. And it's our responsibility in the United States to say no to this kind of intervention, this kind of empire, and instead figure out how to build a new order based on multilateralism, based on respect for institutions like the United Nations. These are imperfect bodies, but this is the best shot we have at a different sort of world. And especially with climate change on the horizon, I think this is the real powder keg. If you saw the destabilizing effects of the amount of refugees that came out of Syria and other places in recent years into Europe, and you saw the response from governments, which was often quite harsh and punitive, and it fostered the rise of some right populist parties in these countries. You can imagine what's going to happen when many more millions of people from sub-Saharan Africa, from parts of South Asia, like Bangladesh, are forced to flee because of the effects of climate change that they had no part in creating.
Bhaskar Sukara, thank you.
That interview was by Afshin Ratansi from his program called Going Underground on Sputnik Radio, the current name for The Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. The European Union has dropped their support for Juan Guaido in his coup attempt in Venezuela. COVID is taking a huge toll across Brazil, but most devastating in the Amazon region. Thousands took to the streets in Australia to protest the current and historic mistreatment of Aboriginal people. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Venezuela's Juan Guaido is a so-called, quote, privileged interlocutor, but no longer considered interim president, European Union states said in a statement on Monday, sticking by their decision to downgrade his status. The EU's 27 states had said on January the 6th they could no longer legally recognize Guaido after he lost his position as head of parliament following legislative elections in Venezuela in December, despite the EU not recognizing that vote. Following the re-election of President Nicolas Maduro in 2018, Guaido, as head of the parliament, became interim president. Guaido is still seen by the United States and Britain as Venezuela's quote-unquote president. The status of interim president gives Guaido the legal right to steal funds confiscated from Maduro by Western governments, as well as affording him access to top officials and supporting his illegal agenda domestically and internationally. With hospitals overrun and supplies of oxygen running out, Brazilian epidemiologist Yesem Orellana said COVID-19 patients' hospital beds in Manaus, the capital of the country's Amazonas region, turned into, quote, asphyxiation chambers. Manaus is lost, said Orellana, who described the city as an open-air laboratory, quote, where all types of negligence and inhumanity are possible, and in which people are dying at home with no medical support. He warned that the collapse of the local healthcare system, propelled in part by the discovery of a potentially more contagious variant of COVID-19 in the region, could happen in other parts of Brazil too. It is not only possible that it will happen, it is already happening, Orellana, who works at the Fiocruz Amazonia, a public health research center in Manaus, told reporters. Quote, there are people in the state of Pará who have died from lack of oxygen. When you start getting low on oxygen supplies, you start having problems with increased demand for hospital beds, and that could have a domino effect. Brazil has recorded the second highest total in the world after the United States, according to Johns Hopkins University data. It has also reported at least 8.8 million cases. The federal government's lack of a cohesive plan to rein in the pandemic or people's behavior has riled medical professionals. Right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro has minimized the gravity of the virus, refused to receive the vaccine, and criticized lockdown and social distancing orders issued by local government officials. Police made arrests in Australia on Tuesday as thousands of people defied public health concerns and protested against the mistreatment of Indigenous people on the day marking the 1788 arrival of the British First Fleet. For many Indigenous Australians who trace their lineage on the continent back tens of thousands of years, the Australia Day holiday is known as Invasion Day, symbolizing the destruction of their cultures by European settlers. In Sydney, indigenous groups called for protests to demand the national day be changed, although state health officials have refused to make an exemption to social distancing rules to allow for crowds of more than 500 people. Television footage showed protesters gathering early on Tuesday in small groups to comply with the limits. Police have warned protesters could face fines and imprisonment for breaching public health orders designed to limit the spread of the novel coronavirus. Images published by news organizations as well as on social media showed police dragging several protesters away from the march in Sydney. In Melbourne, rally organizers said protesters would be sorted into groups of 100 people with 10 meters or 30 feet between each to comply with social distancing rules. Images posted on social media, however, showed a large group of masked protesters gathered at one of the major intersections of the city. They held up their fists in the air and chanted "One Voice."
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this listener-funded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support my efforts like a generous listener in Taos, New Mexico did this week. Many thanks. We will conclude with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. First, brief global COVID news. Riots broke out in Netherlands over curfews imposed to control COVID. Suppliers of the herbicide Agent Orange during the Vietnam War are being sued in France. In Egypt, it is the 10th anniversary of the so-called Arab Spring. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The UK has become the first country in Europe to register more than 100,000 COVID-19 deaths. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he was, quote, deeply sorry for every life lost. He rejected the suggestion that slow action from his government contributed to the high death toll.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador says he has tested positive for COVID-19. That announcement comes as his country registers the highest levels of infections and deaths to date. Israel will close its international airport to nearly all flights in a bid to bring a raging outbreak in the country under control. And Egypt has started vaccinating its population using the Chinese-made Sinopharm shot. Healthcare workers and people with chronic diseases are among the first in line to receive the vaccine. U.S. President Joe Biden has boosted his goal for coronavirus vaccinations to 1.5 million per day during his first 100 days in office. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says her country's borders are likely to remain closed for much of this year. Over the weekend, New Zealand reported its first case of community transmission of the virus in more than 2 months. The Philippines has confirmed domestic transmission of the highly contagious British variant of the coronavirus. And Mexico has surpassed 150,000 confirmed deaths after a surge in infections in recent weeks.
From today, people in Slovakia who want to leave their homes for any reason will be required to carry a certificate showing they have tested negative for coronavirus. Meanwhile, Moscow is easing its COVID restrictions amid a fall in new cases. Bars, restaurants and nightclubs will be allowed to stay open through the night. And a woman in China has been sentenced to a year in prison for hiding her virus symptoms before boarding a flight from the US to China in March. She took medication to suppress a fever.
There's been a second night of unrest in the Netherlands, sparked by a nationwide coronavirus curfew. Rioting and looting hit around 10 cities, and police made at least 150 arrests. Authorities say COVID deniers and football hooligans are behind the protests, which they're struggling to deal with.
On Monday, rioters in Rotterdam fought more street battles with police. It was similar in Harlem and in other cities, too, where protesters also vandalized buildings and shops. Authorities said they were mainly people in their teens. The country's prime minister condemned the violence.
In the eerste plaats dat het...
To begin with, rioting is unacceptable, and that any normal person could only watch it with horror. You really wonder what got into those people. That had nothing to do with protesting. It's criminal violence, and we will be treating it as such. The protests had begun peacefully over the weekend when people demonstrated against the continued lockdown and the country's first nightly curfew since World War II. Parliament had narrowly approved the measure because of the more infectious COVID variant from England hitting the country.
A French court has begun hearing a case against multinationals accused of selling Agent Orange to the U.S. government during the Vietnam War. A French-Vietnamese woman filed the suit in 2014 against firms that made or sold the chemical. She says the herbicide caused her and others grievous bodily harm.
10 years ago, mass protests erupted across Egypt that led to the toppling of longtime President Hosni Mubarak. The uprising was part of the so-called Arab Spring Revolution. It was seen as the dawn of a new era for Egypt. But a decade later, many of those who participated say little has changed.
They call it the Day of Wrath. A day that saw thousands descend on Cairo's Tahrir Square to demand President Hosni Mubarak, who'd ruled Egypt for almost 30 years, leave. Police and security forces cracking down hard. In just a few bloody days, hundreds dead and thousands more injured. But 2.5 weeks after the start of the January 2011 protests, jubilation. Mubarak is out. 6 months later, the Muslim Brotherhood takes power, with Islamist Mohamed Morsi elected president. A year later, he too is gone in a military coup. In the weeks that follow, hundreds of his supporters are arrested and many killed. The coup was led by Army Chief General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. By 2014, he is president. El-Sisi has done all he can to silence any opposition. And after changes to the constitution, he could stay in power until at least 2030. For many, the hopes of January the 25th, 2011, are buried somewhere here in Tahrir Square.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.